Chapter 8, verse 1. I don't know if we want to just do verse 1 and get that out of our off our chest.
Probably.
Because it's a that silence for half an hour could take up the whole time tonight. I mean,
yeah.
Do I hear that we won't be silent for half an hour?
Okay. Yeah.
Do I volunteer myself?
You'll volunteer after this. I thought I would just read that text since it's only one. And very then good. I'll let you read beyond. Mm-hmm. Then when the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Thoughts?
I think it comes directly from Isaiah 52.
And that reads?
My reference is Isaiah 52:13 through 53:9. Which I think should not have been divided by a chapter break.
Isaiah, well, that's very plausible. Isaiah 52:13 through 29, did you say?
Through 53:9.
I do like how that goes into the end of 52. I haven't begun reading 53 yet.
I mean, the messianic prophecy, but I think the prophecy starts there in 52.
Oh, 52. Oh, the suffering servant psalm. Yes, most scholars take that as a unit. The chapters and verses were added during the medieval times.
Yeah, right.
And the verses were added by someone who rode horseback from Clermont, France, to somewhere else in France. And some wonder if he was doing some of his changes, some of his demarkings on horseback. When the horse jogged, he put the separation point in the wrong spot. That's kind of a joke, scholarly joke, but
sometimes it's about that bad.
Sometimes it is about that bad.
In the middle of sentences and stuff.
Yeah, so that's I think every scholar believes that the suffering servant song begins at verse 13 and ends at the end of 53.
Yeah.
You mean because the Lamb was silent before?
Well, it's verse 15, the last verse in 52, the kings shall shut their mouths at him.
Oh, the kings will be silenced because of him, because they will see what they haven't seen before.
Yes.
And that they'll understand. To me, that it makes so much sense that during this silence, clarity is being given.
Yes, yes.
And I think of it too as silence often is a sign of awe.
Mm-hmm.
And with clarity comes awe.
Yes. Yeah.
And Job wanted to be silent, but God wouldn't let him.
Yeah, he insisted.
God says, stand up like a man, you will answer. You will answer. And then the last time he answers is like, okay, I cover my mouth. I really don't have anything to say. I get it now, and I wish I hadn't said anything.
So I remember
of the fact it's half an hour as opposed to an hour or a day or whatever.
Well, just a day time, for a year,
does
right?
The duration. Well, that comes out to a little bit over 7 days, but
I could see 7 days being silent.
Well, I was raised to believe that this is a prophetic half hour, and again, I leave everything open for multiple interpretations. However, I see also a very good reason to connect it to the fascinating study on the hour that Jesus kept talking about.
The hour is coming.
And well, I traced through, especially in John, it's a really interesting study because Jesus several times said, my hour is not yet come. My hour is not yet come. Like, and then all of a sudden he said, the hour has come. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, the hour is here. And I said, well, there's a thread there that is definitely connected to itself. Then he adds another wrinkle to that. And he says, your hour is here, the hour of the power of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
This is your hour. Personally, I think this half hour is linked in with Jesus' multiple references to this hour, and it has to do some way with the grand finale, where the hour of the power of darkness is overlapping his hour, where everything comes to a complete climax. So I see, and this is the last trumpet or the last seal.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much the last of each of these series seems to be the grand finale. So, and that parallels what Jesus is talking about, is the hour has come. Well, the hour of the grand finale.
Could I get a quick recap on the seals and the traditional historicist understanding? I know we did a pretty good job with the first, I don't know, four, maybe five, but where in time is the sixth seal and where in time is the seventh seal?
Well, the sixth seal is when they're calling on the rocks to cover them.
So
by the historicist view, that's the coming of Jesus.
Okay, so that would be the second coming. So this is post second coming.
Well, on the historicist view, I have a problem with that.
Well, I want to get my head around the
right,
the way it's typically understood, so I can ground myself there or orient from that view.
Well, the historicist view that I was raised on, which I think is pretty much what it was, the seventh seal is a half hour in heaven because they said heaven emptied all the angels to go bring the people back. And a half hour is, a week? And it takes a week to get there for whatever reason. Haven't figured that one out.
Yeah.
So there's nothing happening in heaven. That's why it's silent.
I think that Ellen White is using that when she is it early writings or story.
Yeah, she does talk about taking 7 days.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So the sixth seal is the second coming. The seventh seal is the ascension towards heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's possible that we get a tour on the way. That's why it takes, because it doesn't take 7 days for a person, for a single being to, unless people are different. But you think of the angel that came to Daniel in 2 minutes.
So this would be more like, okay, we're going to enter God's realm. Let's get everyone up to speed enough to be on the same page.
In a way, so that they see this creation, they see the planets, they see, it could be a tour guide trip.
Let me orient my thinking is, if at the second coming, we have people from every genuine walk of life, not just Seventh-day Adventists who are going to ascend. And
you got people from all through history, too.
Correct. Right. All through history. All different worldviews, and the distance between us is so little, we thought it was great, the distance between our philosophies. But from God's perspective, the difference of human philosophies is a micromillimeter compared to what his reality is. Mm. So it seems like this tour could be a way of bringing us all kind of up to speed. That's sort of how I'm thinking. Now, has that a fanciful imagination have any basis in biblical reality, or
as they used to say when I was a kid, sanctified imagination?
I don't know. It's how I see the possibility.
Yeah, I like to take all the clues that I can find, and then see what fills in that fits those clues.
I mean, I don't need it to happen at that silence in heaven that takes a half hour to get there.
Another way to look at this in light of the great controversy is that you've had people coming out of the great tribulation in the previous section.
Okay.
And my Bible puts verse 1 in chapter 8 with verse 7, with chapter 7. This is a pause, a great pause in the whole broiling, warring, violent actions of earth. There's silence. There's not the screaming and yelling and carrying on that we've been doing for the last how many years? Thousands of years. I'm not negating what you said, Bill.
Oh, no. I
see multiple possibilities for the same verse.
I agree. I'm connecting the dots in my head with how the sixth seal story ends with the seventh seal. And I appreciate the pause of silence and, in essence, peace. The lack of the conflict, even if there's tension in the conflict, there's a pause in the expression of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just have a question, you know, as I'm trying to read it in context and try to think new thoughts. You know, we have the sixth seal and then you have this intermission. You have this timeout period, which is reflected in both the trumpets and, if I remember correctly, the bowls. I could be wrong on that one. But there's this intermission, and I go, you know, what's happening during that intermission, of course, is the sealing of 144,000, right? And then, you know, again, this angelic worshiping of God and glory giving to God for what he's about, which everybody on earth doesn't get, but at least the court in heaven gets. And then this amazing, we weren't here for the discussion, but I appreciated what you guys said about in Revelation 7, where it says they will never go hungry or be thirsty again. Sun will not beat down on them, nor any burning heat, you know, because the Lamb, you know, ends up being the one to lead, which makes sense because this is a lamb that's been slaughtered from the foundation of the world. So Jesus alone is able to lead us in that path of self-denial and trusting God and those essential elements. So, you know, ultimately he wipes tears from everybody's eye. And I go, to me, it just makes sense that there's just this awe about what God is up to. You know, this, I've had the experience of sometimes being so stunned. There are no words. And I heard kind of reference to that, this just sense of awe and appreciation, you know, before the last trumpets, which is my understanding growing, is this is when some of those satanic forces are released. You know, anyway, that's a, I've been listening to Siegfried Tonstedt and he talks a lot about that. So it's just this affirmation in the end of chapter 6, where, you know, 7, sorry, where God's got this and he triumphs and it's all going to work out and God wins and people are going to make it through, which is really critical when you think about being on earth during that unleashing of satanic forces. Anyway, just a thought.
So I don't know. That brings me into thinking, wondering that the sixth trumpet isn't the second coming, but something before it, because the seventh seal has this trumpets that seem like, and especially the narrative, that there's this tension still of will they, won't they? Will they change their mind or won't they change their mind? And if this was this, if the sixth seal is the second coming, why are we having that tension still?
Yeah, good point. Yeah, it doesn't seem to fit the flow of what's
the only,
coming next.
The only way, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was just saying, it seemed to Jesus coming and everything's well, no more pain, sorrow, you know.
Then we jump back into war. Yeah. The only way it could work is if we see John taking us to the end, then starting over, taking us to the end, and that sort of thing, which has been the traditional way of reading it.
I've viewed the cycles of sevens. The thing that makes sense to me, sort of, each one of those, I have to use like an illustration to even make sense out of it. But if you look at a wheel with spokes on it, so if you had seven spokes, and then as the wheel rolls, you know, one by one, the spokes cover so much territory, right, on the ground. But if you had different size wheels, if you had a big wheel, then it's going to cover a whole lot more area turning one full rotation than a small wheel with seven spokes. If you took the number seven as the end, the grand finale, so you lined up each of the wheels starting with the seventh instead of the first, and then you roll them back, but they're different sizes. So the sevens that have a big wheel are going to go way back further to start, whereas a smaller wheel is going to only go back a certain amount. And then they're all rolling forward at different linear speeds, but they all end up at number seven at the same time.
So there's a part of me that just enjoys a good read and an understanding of a straight read without having to jump through
spokes.
Hoops or spokes. I get the possibility of multiple interpretations. And so I'm kind of asking for a simple one. As I read through this and I see a cosmic conflict that started in heaven and the seals are breaking at a certain time in order to reveal truth, universal truth. And if I leave behind anything about specifics of earth time, can I appreciate this from that cosmic level and say, okay, the sixth isn't necessarily about the second coming. How does it reveal the cosmic conflict and its solution? And then the seventh, and it's the things, because you have the seventh seal, and then you have seven trumpets, and then you have seven
bowls
and seven thunders, which we don't get any information
about. Right.
I'm way ahead. I get that. So I'm trying to set my mind stage for I've popped the seventh seal and now there's silence and there's a whole bunch of stuff coming. How, if I'm, I think the one cosmic one was the devil, the adversary, the chief adversary is sowing seeds about the character of God and he's going out on conquest. And the result of that is the second seal where he takes peace from the universe and violence follows. And I forget how we talked about the other ones. So that's where I'm losing the sixth and the seventh, because I get so caught up in the deeply embedded things of this earth's history. And I think they overlap, but I'm trying to separate in my head, and that's where I'm struggling.
Well, you know, Bill, and I'm looking for it here. It's fallen out of my computer as to have some other things of value. I created an overarching chronological order of revelation many years ago, and I'm trying to find it here. I saw it not too long ago, but for some reason I'm not finding it.
Well, by the way, you read something to us the other day that you only had paper copies of.
I sent it out.
You did?
I did. Did you not get it?
No, I don't remember seeing it.
Did anybody else get it?
Did it come from Jane?
We haven't looked.
It was the Great Revelation hymn and the summary.
I think I saw that. That was not recently.
It was 2 weeks ago.
I got it.
Oh, I do have it. Yeah, September 24.
Well, I may have completely lost it.
Okay, I see something here with an attachment.
Seven stanzas.
There it is. Okay.
Yeah.
I got it. I just didn't open it, I guess.
I don't know, unless God answers my prayer with a miracle. it's forever gone, so I'll just have to tell you about it.
No, she's talking about something else.
I'm talking about my, I had an outline of Revelation from a chronological order. And what I came, as I recall, and this is, you know, without that, I don't know if I could come up with it again. So you might offer a prayer for me that I can find it. Things tend to disappear. Anyway, I saw the seven trumpets as opposition. I saw the first seals as depicting opposition from within the church. And I was taking the more historicist view. And I saw the trumpets, the seven trumpets, as giving opposition from outside the church, against the church.
And by the church, are you meaning Christianity as a whole or Adventism?
Yeah, specifically? As the followers of the Lamb.
Okay, gotcha.
I agree that these sets of sevens could be overlapping, but they're from different perspectives. So, for instance, if you're talking about it from, I don't know, like a religious perspective and a political perspective, I'm not saying that's what it is, but
yeah,
you're trying to describe it through a different lens. So you need to start over and, okay, now we're going to go through the sevens, but we're going to look at it from a completely different angle.
That's kind of what I was doing, only I was a little more concrete about it.
Right.
I've really appreciated Siegfried Tonstad. I'm trying to get through those. And they're so outside my kind of thinking after going to multiple Revelation seminars. I really appreciate his saying, you know, what have we missed as the historicists? You know, Uriah Smith, and there's some other guy in the 1980s who kind of updated and altered things. But I haven't got to the next presentation where he starts specifically addressing the seven trumpets, but it's been really impactful in saying, what have we missed? What does that fail to do? And a lot of it really fails. Some of the historicist perspective is on these, you know, dates, and Uriah Smith, you know, identified the barbarian tribes that invaded. And then it's really refreshing because his focus is on the character of God and the big picture. Mm-hmm. And what do we miss when we just get down to a few dates and instead of just saying, you know, there's evidence about these realities, the cosmic realities of these demonic forces. And so much of at least the historical Adventist view has still had a retributive God where he is the right one who's sending bad stuff, and he's the one that ultimately kills. You know, it's not a good picture of God. So I've got to get through the rest, but that's been eye-opening to me because I've always said, oh, I'm an historicist, and you know, I had struggled through some of the previous interpretations of the trumpets from that perspective because I go, what's that relate to today and all these terrible, awful things that are happening, you know? So anyway, that's something I will hopefully continue to get through and have that be informative as I listen to you guys and your perspective and try to, most importantly, listen to what God's saying.
Yeah.
What's he trying to get through?
Yeah, thank you. I just noticed something here on the fifth angel and his trumpet. Oh, wait a minute. I'm jumping in the middle. I'll save that.
That'd be a good place.
Mark, well, raised his hand.
I you know, one of Sigvis thrust from what I've heard you say, I haven't had time to listen to him, but one of the thrusts that I've heard you seem to say that, you know, he keeps pointing us to the who's the one in control of all the suffering. And it's obviously Satan, you know, Satan's the cause. And that seems to be true in the fifth angel. Fifth angel blew his trumpet. This is the beginning of chapter 9. And I saw a star that had fallen from heaven to earth. Who's that star?
Right.
Well, angels in the Bible and the Old Testament are stars. Sons of God, stars sang for joy, and the sun. Well, I got that mixed up. But in Job, 38. So he was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. Who gives the key to him? Well, God in the book of Job gives Satan the key to Job. So it's obvious within those verses that we're dealing with what Satan can do.
Right. Right.
And that's exactly when Siegfried was talking about that. He immediately went to the fifth angel. He said, okay, what does this tell us? Who is unleashing these terrible forces against, you know, exactly. The earth, the people, everything? This is not the character of God. Instead right. of what is usually attributed to God is, and again, it's the back to that, you know, divine sovereignty perspective that often confuses people. Who's actually doing these terrible, awful things?
Well, and later on in the same chapter, verse 11 says, their king is an angel from the abyss whose Hebrew name is Abaddon and whose Greek name is Apollyon. So I'm wondering, you know, if we should go ahead and read maybe chapter 8, verse 2 to chapter through verse 5 before we really jump into this.
Well, we had a couple of hands come up during this time.
Oh, we did. Sorry.
Yeah. Shall we try that with Mark?
William and Mark both had raised their hands.
Okay, well, why don't we stop and take their hands? William?
Well, I lowered my hand because I had a question going back, and I don't want to go too far back, but I figured if I could be quiet for a space of a half an hour, that might be awesome.
Well, go ahead. My question is,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
My question was towards what Floyd had said in Isaiah 52. One of the things that I had noticed there before they used the term sprinkling, that Yeshua was going to sprinkle upon the kings. And I thought that was interesting in light of what we've been talking about in that space of an hour. And I didn't know if Floyd could elaborate a little bit on that, please.
There's also a couple other passages that mention silence, I think, that could be relevant to this, too.
Are there any other passages that have half an hour?
I don't think so.
That's pretty unique, it seems like.
It is. Yeah, the only references I have here, I don't think there's any that say half an hour, but I have John 12:23 when he says the time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And then 17:1, the time has come, glorify your name.
Right. That's the word hour there.
Yeah.
Because hour did represent time as in.
Now Habakkuk 2:20, that Yahweh is in his holy temple, let all the earth
keep silent for him.
And Zechariah 2:13, be silent, all flesh, before Yahweh, for he has roused himself from his holy habitation.
Yeah. What version are you using?
The web version.
Oh, and they use Yahweh, huh?
Yes, they do, in the Old Testament.
I should check that one out because
I really like it. I find it more favorable to a good view of God.
I contend, and I teach this to my students, that Adonai is a substitute for Yahweh. It is not Yahweh. It's came out of the exile when they decided they were going to really keep the Ten Commandments. And consequently, they led us to kind of misrepresent Yahweh by Adonai. Because what happened is that this carried into the Greek Septuagint and then into the Latin Vulgate and then into our English translations. Anyway, that's one of my little bandwagons. I get one. Who else was asking?
Mark.
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 We're ready for you.
Yeah, this was, I a follow on from, I think, maybe where Nancy was going, at least what I heard from it. Also from long ago, Dr. Nice, who said, well, Daniel Revelation made for us to read tomorrow's news, but to understand today's newspaper. I've often thought that, you know, we get, it seems to me, wrapped around the axle by trying to identify specific things and associate them with these, this symbolic language, rather than just saying God's trying to tell us how the battle between good and evil plays out. That, you know, these mm-hmm. kinds of things happen. Be ready for them without trying to say, okay, this is this, this is this. I don't know.
I think it's in our
Adventist history. This is the way they did it, but I wonder if maybe it's time to let it go.
Well, we should at least not let it eclipse our view of the theology of Revelation, because it's sort of like dissecting a cadaver, if I can bear to use that illustration. You know, we get so caught up in the skeleton, which is, by the way, the one thing you don't dissect. But we act like that's all we have to dissect. We have to match each part of the skeleton to something in the future. And we forget that this cadaver has muscle and organs and flesh and what have you. Decadent flesh, of course. But what we've done, and this all what we've done, is dangle the skeleton in front of people for all these Revelation seminars, which I thank God I've never gone to more than one.
Wow.
And I've only gone to one night of that one.
So you don't know what we've suffered through.
I just decided I avoid suffering when I can.
I grew up on them.
I'm sure that's why they have a hard time letting go of it, because it does appeal to a certain gee whiz kind of checkout stand inquirer type of minds, you know, and it's hard to let go of. But I don't think it serves us well.
It has never attracted me. What has attracted me is the theology of Revelation.
And this is the question I have is, if we're going to promote prophecy, biblical prophecy, is it about the details of tying one thing to a physical reality, or is it about saying, and I want to try and paraphrase Mark on this one, that there's a principle behind this conflict between God and an adversary, and that principle as prophetic truth is sure and true?
But why does it have to be one or the other exclusive?
Well, I live my life and I may die before the very end of time, and those principles still play out.
Right.
But if I'm just saying it's going to be something that unfolds at the end of time,
I'll piggyback on Floyd's comment. I think it can be both. I think what's happened is we've over-excluded theology.
Yes.
To the point where we've had ad nauseum with the skeleton approach, and it no longer helps, because there's no name in Revelation that would give us Saddam Hussein.
Right.
There's no name in Revelation that would give us Putin. There's no name in Revelation that would give us XYZ in history. And what if you study the history of Adventist evangelism, it's pretty sad, because evangelists would take, say, World War I. They were certain that was going to be Armageddon. They were certain that was going to be the end. And they preached it like it was, and they got hundreds and thousands of converts, and then it wasn't. And the same thing happened in World War II. You would think that we would, maybe there's more to Revelation than just dates and events on a timeline. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's an attempt by people to get psychologically prepared for just anything, but history tends to repeat itself. If you get prepared for one, to get, if you get, now I can't think.
Psyched up.
Yeah, if you get ready for one event, haven't you, in a part, gotten ready for another event?
Except if that first event goes by, then you're like, oh, it didn't happen. Let's celebrate October 22, and not as a disappointment, but as a new beginning. Then, yes, we could maintain our preparation. But if it didn't, and then we let it slide.
Well, and I see, again, our tendency to look back at events more than their meaning.
Right.
Leads us astray. Because the great disappointment led the church to new ground, to higher ground, to a better understanding of God, to recognize that God loved the world and he wasn't just going to come back and say, I'm done with everybody else. I'm going to take you home. You know, it led to a whole lot of good truths that we needed.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's time for that to happen again.
I do too. To me, I want the whole body of Revelation, the flesh, the blood, the sinews, the fiber, the everything.
And that's what I've been finding in this round through Revelation over the last 3 years, is every verse is coming alive when I look at it through the lens of Jesus' version of God. I have never even remotely seen so much beauty and fantastic, exciting things coming out of everywhere. Just, I never imagined it was in there.
Yeah. Okay, so Bill, why don't you go ahead and read?
There was one more question from Brad.
Oh, Brad, sorry.
One more quick thought. What if Revelation is simply a narrative or a story, as Jesus would? That's a drama being played out. And we've heard the phrase, wait for it. What if a half hour pause in heaven is some of the drama of, and wait for it. And here comes the best part. What catches your attention better than something that you don't know when it's coming? Just a thought.
Well, with that in mind, I think that's a beautiful segue. I hear God saying, wait for it. And now we're going to read about a few trumpets.
There you go.
Well, there's one more idea about the silence that came to me a few minutes ago. It's not in the Bible, but, you know, when Ellen White says that when Jesus appears and the saints look, and the awesomeness actually creates fear. And they're questioning, am I really ready?
Yeah.
And then she says there is an awesome period of silence. And it's like they're going, waiting and wondering. And it's, to me, it's like it's burning out the last vestiges of doubt out of their heart. And Jesus waits. Very specifically, and she said they're just like this mixture of anticipation and terror, because they're waiting to hear, you know, are we accepted or are we not accepted? Is our belief, you know, enough? And then finally he says, my grace is sufficient for you.
Yes.
And that period, what if that period was literally a half hour?
Could be.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really a new thought.
So I may not have heard you completely, Floyd, because I had a moment of trigger thinking about the movie Notting Hill, and that there's an asking for reconsideration and there's a pregnant pause before the answer is given. So my thought is, anyone who has intimacy with God wouldn't be concerned about his response to them. That, you know, it's not, is it enough? Because we know we are included. It seems like there's an adversarial pregnant response that has somehow tried to get between. I don't know, because I just keep thinking, my issue isn't with God, it's with the adversarial representation of fake God on earth.
Mm-hmm. So could I offer something? My assurance of salvation has always rested in my assurance of God and who he is. If I were to actually see him in all his glory, I would be so awed, and I would realize the reality. I mean, we don't see him face to face. We don't get the full reality of his love. And that full reality of his love would just impact me so that I would go, who shall be able to stand? Can anybody stand in his presence?
Yeah.
Which is what actually she says happens.
Right.
I just don't see it as fear.
No, I didn't.
But awe, I can see awe.
Yeah. I don't see it as the kind of fear where Satan's trying to pump it into me or something. Right. I don't see it as that. And I don't see it as terror. I see it as just wondering, how can I stand in his presence when he's this so overwhelmingly loving? And I feel uncertain inadequacy. I'm a human being, and I still have yet to sit down with him and talk with him personally in real life.
For me, I would have to say that encounter for the first time, you know, I can say I have boldness right now, but when there's something so overwhelming, I'll guarantee you there's going to be residual stuff from my past left over that's going to come up and say, are you sure? Are you sure? And that, I think, is what Jesus wants to come up and get flushed out forever.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's terror in that there's a reason for terror. It's terror from my past that's still lingering that needs to be exposed and expelled.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And in the light of who he really, really is, right?
Yes.
His glory, Shekinah, it burns up and it's jettisoned.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. But he needs that time for this reality check to soak in.
We're not ready to just go right into his presence and we can't handle that. There has to be that space to prepare us for reality.
Yeah. Thank you for talking that through with me, because I was having a little trouble.
I have lots of triggers for you, Bill.
It's okay. It's good. So not to end that one, but should I read?
Yes, go ahead and read.
Okay. So we know that verse 1, this is Revelation 8, Free Bible Version. The seventh seal was opened. There was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. Verse 2, I saw the seven angels that stand before God. They were given seven trumpets. Then another angel came and stood at the altar. He had a golden censer, and he was given a large quantity of incense to add to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar that stands in front of the throne. The smoke of the incense rose together with the prayers of the saints before God from the hand of the angel. The angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it down upon the earth. There was the sound of thunder with lightning flashes and a terrible earthquake. Then the seven angels holding the seven trumpets prepared to blow them.
The thought that struck me about the thunder voices, lightning and earthquake, not the voices maybe so much, But you would hear those too. It's the foot of the cross. There's lightning flashing as though God is angry. And of course, in so many cultures, lightning signifies an angry God. Thor, for example, the Norwegian god.
That cluster shows up like bookmarks throughout Revelation. Strategic transition points or whatever. And that cluster, each time it shows up, it adds one more thing to it. And the next time you read it, it adds one more thing to it. That's definitely a thread.
Maybe the voices is the thing added here.
Yeah,
thunder, lightning, and earthquake. No, and we have thunder, voices, lightning, and earthquake.
I've got that all sequenced out somewhere, but that's a fascinating study just in itself. And also the order in which they're listed, I think, could be also. I called it a transition tab. And it starts in Revelation 4, 5, and then again, and then here in 8, and then in 11, 19, and then again in 16, 18.
How often does God, is that representative of God or something else? Because we see God on Mount Sinai with several of those. Some of my translations don't include voices. NET didn't, I didn't see it in FBV. But what is the significance then of all of those?
Well, that's sort of open for interpretation. You have to look at, for me, it's like, I see Revelation as this fantastic drama production. Like we would do a stage play or a movie or something. And even, you know, the first chapter is like introducing the actors, listing the main characters or whatever, as well as in the middle of the book. But then, you know, if you're watching a drama on TV and then there comes a certain place and suddenly the music alerts you that something's changing. You know what I'm saying? And you may not even notice, but the music is changing and your feelings change and you're anticipating something about to happen. And then the next time there may be some special visual effects that accompany the music. That's what I see happening, is these are some sort of indicators and they're synchronized. They're synchronizing something. I leave things like that open sometimes, but I just see the pattern. If I can't explain it, that's okay. I still see there's a pattern there. And then over even sometimes a year or two, as I go back and forth, and it's like, oh, now I'm starting to see what it means. So I'm just pointing it out as it is a pattern. There is an increase each time it shows up. I think that means something. I don't know what, but I think it does mean something.
I just think it has ties to the death of Jesus.
Okay. Flashbacks?
Not the voices maybe so much, but the earthquake, the lightning, the thunder. You always have thunder with lightning. I'm trying to think which gospel highlights that. Is it Luke maybe? Nope, not Luke. I doubt if Mark would have it. So I'm looking at Matthew. Here it is. Matthew 27:51. Look, the curtain of the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rock split, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised.
That could be voices.
Yeah. Well, and if you combine that with Luke, they go home beating their chests, and there could be voices with that. The one thing it does not have in Revelation that one of the gospel writers, I think maybe John, has, and that is darkness, intense darkness. But that's present with the plagues, the last
plague. Right, right. And I think that at the end of the plagues is where this last time this cluster shows up. And there's, and in that instance, there is not something added. It, you know, the list gets longer each time it shows up.
Mm-hmm.
In that time, it's not longer, but it's stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes out of the way to say a mighty earthquake like has mm-hmm. never, you know,
right.
It's like, so it's like, okay, this is the last one and it's all out kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of looking ahead because we've talked about the trumpets and the plagues, bowls, whatever. And are these, again, I'm being caught up into events as opposed to looking at these as a principle and saying, you know, like in the first trumpet, a third of the earth was burned up and a third of the trees were burned up and the green grass and all of the green grass was burned up. How, I mean, this is a symbolic book of revealing a big picture. How much of this, and then we get multiple thirds to where everything is burned up, or is it a reducing? What is the principle by which we should actually understand this?
I've said before that the principle I use in my study comes from the very first verse of the book. And I have two rules that I stick to, and it's worked very, very well for me. The first is everything has to agree with Jesus' version of God. The second rule is I approach every verse, every item as first and primarily symbolic. And I flush it for all it's worth to try to get everything I can out of the symbology until it's wrung dry. And then if there's anything left over, okay, it could be physical too.
Okay. So I'm looking at this imagery. The angel took the incense container and filled it with fire from the altar, threw it down to the earth. And that's where there was thunder and voices, lightning, and so on. So he took it from the altar. That's the place of atonement. I mean, that's the place of sacrifice. That's the place. Or unless it's the incense altar.
Unless it's the incense altar.
It's the incense yeah. altar. You're right.
I think it is.
So the prayers of the prayers of the saints rose up before God from the angel's hands.
And that's also in chapter 5, isn't it?
That's what I was wondering. How long, God, before you act?
Right. Under the altar. The saints are under the altar.
Because in 5:8, which is before the throne, when the Lamb shows up, it says golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints.
Mm-hmm. So what if we understood this to mean in part, and I don't see this as the whole picture, but as what if we saw this to mean that what happens in this chapter is in part in relation is a response of heaven to the prayers of the saints. There's communication between heaven and earth constantly going on. And we can't know for sure what they were praying. Then you have the seven angels who held the seven trumpets got ready to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet and hail and fire mixed with blood. Why mixed with blood? That's very out of natural sequence. Was thrown down to the earth.
It goes perhaps to the comment I had made earlier about sprinkling. Symbolic of the sprinkling of the blood or sacrifice of the priest. So moving forward from that, perhaps.
And we saw a sprinkling in Isaiah 52.
Yeah.
It's sprinkling like, of the like, nations.
Yep. So it's kind of like, you know, that comment that was made about the Hebrew being dynamic. So in that kind of moving on kind of thought, the Hebrew common of 6 yea 7 or 7 yea 8 in this case on these chapters might apply. It may be that space of time. As you say, Floyd, it has that that track, if you will, or it has that pattern, I believe you said.
Mm-hmm.
I like the way that you phrased it because it kind of reminds me of being at a point in time in a play where, you know, like, where there's a nervousness, almost like a heightened elation about this last, what do they call it, act, I guess. And then the beginning of maybe a intermission or a transition, you know, where they change the stage and put up new props or whatnot. And then they go on with the play. You know, you kind of look around in awareness and you're heightened and you might discuss it with whomever you were enjoying it with at that point in time.
In verse 2, I find it interesting when it says, I saw the seven angels who stand before God. Matthew 18:10, Jesus said, see that you don't despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. And then Luke 1:19, the angel answered him, I am Gabriel who stands in the presence of God. I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. I think every phrase in Revelation is significant. The one it says they were standing in the presence of God, I'm like, well, what might that mean? Like, don't all angels stand in the presence of God? Well, I think there are specific ones that maybe stand more in the presence of God.
Well, and maybe this does say specifically the angels, the seven angels who stand.
Yes, yes. So then I was looking for any other references that talk about standing in the presence of God, and those two came up. And I sort of wondered, well, is this symbolic of the angels, even the guardian angels, of those who are being loyal to God? So they are keeping this direct communication open between their agents on earth and God in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, could that be what the seven angels represent? And we haven't even touched on the idea that trumpets is a direct link back to the Old Testament blowing of the trumpets involving the feast and other major events.
Well, the fall of Jericho.
Yes, and that was another time of silence too. Because mm-hmm. In fact, I had that in there. Joshua says, you shall not make any noise until I tell you.
So I had a thought about the angels in the presence of God. And maybe this is trigger point, Floyd, so I don't know, but we have a direct advocate from the Father to us always, and that's the Spirit, God himself. So what purpose do angels before God have? And to me, that's bearing witness in the greater conflict. Are they bearing witness for people against the accusation and God, so that there is, you know, we have a council, we have, anyway, I see it less about us and our needs, except to let us know that we are represented in heaven, but we're represented in heaven by God himself. So again, the idea of there's an accuser. But even now in the New Testament era, the accuser's thrown down. And I don't even think we're being accused anymore, except by our, you know, in our own minds. So I'm, what function do angels have at the throne of God that isn't, well, I guess that maybe it's just period. What function do the angels have?
Yeah, the text that came to mind for me is they're ministering spirits sent forth to minister. They're there to help us. They're, you know, so this is an integral, right now they're going to play a very integral, hey, let's get your attention, you know, get your attention.
They are also part of the communication system between heaven and earth.
The nervous system.
Angel means messenger.
So they could be the nervous system, the communication link, the telephone wire, whatever.
And you, I think you mentioned this earlier, Gene, but I think it's so beautiful how this incense, the prayers of the saints, all of that happens before they go out. You know, it's it just shows God's responsiveness, his sensitivity, his deep awareness of what's going on and how that affects timing.
Well, this also relates to the seals in the foreheads, as we'll find out in chapter 9.
How much of the illustration of the Jewish temple service is present in this? You know, the incense and
the altar,
the altar and things like that, as a purpose, as an understanding of drawing a callback to remind us about something in God's mind towards us.
Mark's been using up the patience of the saints here.
Mark.
I was trying to get in my half hour of silence. Well, so the angel standing before God, and the whole thing with the angels being representatives of the children and God's messengers, to me, it just says that, well, even here on earth, God seems to delegate. I mean, he put Adam and Eve in charge of the earth. And I think that's an example of the way he runs his universe. He creates people with abilities, and then he says, hey, go do something. But in the case, but what the angel standing in front of God in this particular case, to me, says is that this is trying to tell us that God's taken care of this one himself. Yeah, he's using other beings, but God's directly in charge of this one.
And they're taking orders directly from him.
Yeah, this is his. He's not delegating the handling of bringing back his children or the problem of evil to somebody else. God's taking care of this one himself. God's directly directing. Got to be a better way to say that. God's directing this one.
Now, I would also, in my opinion, the angels, not always, but I am increasingly viewing particularly the seven angels, the seven bowls angels and the seven trumpets angels, which I think is the only two place that they have those. I'm not too convinced that those are literal angels. We have always taught that the three angels' messages are not three literal angels, and yet we're very hesitant to apply that to everywhere else. I think the same thing should apply to these angels as well as to the bowls angels. I believe they very possibly represent people on earth, groups, movements, whatever.
Are you saying you might be an angel, Floyd?
It's a symbol. It's a symbol.
No, I mean, everyone, if the purpose of or the meaning of an angel is a messenger.
Yeah, a messenger.
Why couldn't you be a messenger?
Right. Whoever opens the mouth and the message comes out, you can be called an angel.
So would you go so far as to say that this could represent the giving of truth to the world and its effects?
Yeah.
When it's rejected.
Definitely.
See, okay, that's something I can sink my teeth into.
Yeah, that connotates.
And these people are learning to stand in the presence of God before the throne. They are connecting directly with God. They are receiving the inspiration of God to deliver whatever it is trumpets are blowing. They are conveying messages directly from the throne, not individually, but collectively.
I need to come back and still get my head wrapped around, Gene, the idea of the principle. So could you say what you said again? Do you have that?
Well, I was just asking, and I'm not necessarily sure about this, but
okay.
I was just asking if it was possible that these seven angels represent the messages that are being delivered to the world by angels and human beings. I think the angels help us by ministering to people that we talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be a combination of that and the messages. And then when it's that message is resisted, things happen. And see, I am a believer, and this is, I suppose, I'm taking this too literally. But I'm a believer that, and I've told the story about my mother and her gardening experience, that how we treat, how we respond to anybody and everybody, and how we behave affects this world for good or for evil.
Our disposition.
And I've seen that work so much with me. With cats. I used to feed seven cats in my community that were homeless. And if I say one cat decided to steal another cat's food, which is very common, and I let loose and yelled at that cat, all the cats would scatter. They were just like, we're out of here. She's angry. We don't want to deal with her. And I had to learn, you know, that doesn't work. It's bad for the cats. So I had to learn other ways of dealing with them, which were part of God's trying to get me to have a better character, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that might be, that's a very good way of putting it, a reflection of the Father on you. I was wondering if perhaps this might be like all eyes on you, all cat eyes on you, so to speak. If this might be a spirit, or these might be spirits that might be seen below the altar, so to speak, when we think about the angels that carry the chariot of the Father, is this a beginning of intercession?
You're talking about Ezekiel?
Yeah. Could it be both, in other words? I mean, like you said, why do we always relate to three or seven, or, you know, two wings or four wings or six, that kind of thing? It just came to mind. It's a question, probably for another day. But
well, I think of seven as being complete. So the seven angels are the complete number of those who are in front of God, whatever number that might be.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've been looking for something that helps me. And if I have seven trumpets or seven thunders or seven bowls, what are those messages that God and God's people are sharing that is being rejected? That's a natural question that I'm going to
have. Yeah, I think that's a fair question, which I, from the context, I can't tell you. So I could be wrong.
I like the idea. I mean, seven is complete. I like the word holistic.
Holistic.
Yeah. So God uses seven, and then it needs all seven to make up a whole.
Well, and so one of the messages is the character of God.
Right.
And to me, part of that is who the universe is intended to be and is in God, and that which it is outside of God, which is a ceasing of existence. So at least that's how we see these things. And so I'm just teasing out in my mind what, if I could come up with seven messages that are interrelated to the the great controversy. But then there's a lot more than just seven.
They take the angels take the prayers. This is before the trumpets are blown. They take the prayers of all the saints. He was given a large amount of incense in order to offer it on behalf of the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar in front of the throne. This has to do with the effects of the atonement, it seems like to me, on the gold altar in front of the throne. Now this, on the other hand, this could be the altar of incense. So that
I think it is, because it's before the throne.
It has to do with the communication between God and human beings. Okay, this is what makes sense to me now. What I perceive now in looking at this is the same thing that you have a little bit of in chapter 7, where the winds are being held. Now the winds are about to be unleashed. And the trumpets blow as a herald of what happens when people pray. And depending on their picture of God, you know, does God ever answer prayers that, I don't know. I don't know that I want to follow this one through. Go ahead, Nancy. I'll take a pause.
I read Jennings' paraphrase of Revelation 8, and it seems to fit with what we're discussing. And starting with 5, it says, "Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth." This symbolized the Holy Spirit empowering God's spokesperson to reveal the truth with stunning clarity. An incredible shaking of the minds of people, accompanied by flashes of brilliance that battled rumblings of confusion and the thunder of opposition. Then the seven angels holding the seven trumpets prepared to sound them, which represents seven warning messages of truth, trumpeting the approaching end and exposing Satan's counterfeits to God's remedy.
Well, that, you know, you can follow that in imagery through chapter 8, because the sea gets affected, the earth gets affected, the stars of the third of the stars, and we're back to these thirds. The day lost a third of its light, and the night lost a third of its light too. So it was very dark. Which would be if the more truth you pour out, or the more truth gets blown from the trumpets, the more the earth rejects it, at least a third of it.
True. Yes.
Well, and a third of the angels in heaven.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Try to get our attention to this bigger picture. What does one third? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was helpful to me. You know, I know that it's a paraphrase, but I go, that makes a whole lot more sense to me. Especially because it's God sending something that is to help, not, you know, taking the literal interpretation. Well, this burns up and this burns up and this is, you know, that's destruction. And God is not about destruction, but shaking us up, getting our attention, bringing the truth so we can make decisions.
And this is what happens when the truth gets rejected. I'm wondering how much more we want to do.
I think before we get into the trumpets in detail, this is probably a good breaking place, given time.
Agreed.
Yeah, I think you're right. So let's have prayer, and then we'll pause for next week. Father in heaven, we know that you are the source of truth. You are the way, the truth, and the life through Jesus and your revelation through him. We ask, as we continue to work through Revelation, that you will open our minds and help us to see the truths, the theology, the themes that are so pregnant in this book and so full of meaning. May we give us vision, give us perception, and help us to understand and appreciate the revelation you have given us here. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.